Welcome to the Everyday Novelist 2020 NaNoWriMo right through day 19. We've got 11 days left. We're getting to the end soon. Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. I am your host, J. Daniel Sawyer, and I am joined by your other host,
Kitty Nakian.
And joining us are our regular panel of writers,
Tori
and
Alexis
and
Gail Carriger.
Hey, how's everybody doing today? Alexis, let's start with you. How are you today?
Do you have to start with me?
Well, you don't have to.
Don't you want a positive
Tori,
start?
I'll do it. I'll take one for the team. I'll do it.
Tori, how are you today?
So I did 88, 15. That 80, was my...
8815. So you got 804 total today. How's the story going?
Okay, I may have questions for you guys later, but okay. I'm still trying to remember them. But I had them, I was writing, I was like, ugh, I need to ask people these questions.
Alrighty. How about you, Kitty?
Not too bad. I had 4,720 at the end of the day.
Giving you a daily total of 530 words for the day. Yes?
4720.
Oh, 4720, sorry. 4720. 550 words for today.
Which I think might be my best day yet.
Actually, it is.
Oh, snap!
Best day so far.
Yes.
Good job.
Yes.
Hell yeah. So,
congratulations. How's the story going?
I'm starting to feel the story.
Ooh. 550 is almost enough for a solid scene, depending on your story writing rhythm.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. How about you, Alexis?
Zero.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
You look like you're still hurting. Is your back still killing you?
It's not as bad as it was yesterday, but I can still feel it.
Ouch. I have had back days like that. You have my unreserved sympathies.
Thank you.
How about you, Gail?
How
are things with you?
Pretty good, I think. 74248. I had to delete quite a bit, but we'll see.
1752 for the day.
Yeah.
Not bad.
Okay, good. That's better than I thought, considering how much I had to delete.
Would you, like, write a scene that you just didn't work and you had to cut, or...?
Yeah, so I had a bumper day yesterday, and then there was a whole section of the, like, because it's, like, the exam final test kind of thing, and there was a whole section where I was like, oh, that's not the right way for this test to happen. I had to put different, like, restrictions in place. So I had to go in and delete several paragraphs and then just rewrite that bit.
I hate that.
Yeah, it happens. It happens.
It does.
But it's stronger this way, and it makes more in-world continuity sense this way, so I like it better.
Cool.
Yeah, and then my characters wanted a little tiny bit of a sex scene. I was like, you guys have not wanted to be in bed with each other the entire story, and suddenly you're like, oh no, all of the stressors are off us, and now we want to leap into bed together. And I was like, well, that kind of makes sense. But I'm still keeping this YA, so it's very, like, you know. It's very much the beginnings, but not the end of a sex scene.
Nonetheless, it does fit with the general part of the book you're in, barreling towards the climax, so to speak.
Yeah, it totally does.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
Sorry, couldn't resist.
The denouement, as it were. Yeah, so that's
excellent.
Sort of how... that's where I stopped. I'm done. I mean, I've finished what of the sex scene I'm going to write, which is not much, which is kind of nice, since I've been writing a lot of sex scenes in the past couple of years, and I'm tired of writing sex scenes.
Now you get to be a little more demure.
I do.
Yeah, I've been likewise shocked in this book. The sex scenes are way tame compared to what I know.
It's funny when the characters are like that. The characters are like, no, yep. we're a little prudish. And I'm like, oh, you're my character? Fine.
Uh-huh.
If you must. But like,
my characters are 14, so that's probably not going to happen.
Well, in the context of my universe, it makes sense, since this is a really, like... touch-averse social structure for various reasons. So, like, intimacy is, like, sort of jealously guarded and stuff. But, And in Dan, in your case, it kind of makes sense, too, if they feel like people are watching them all the time and they're and they're non-exhibitionists, then they're, you know.
They've got that going on, and they're also coming out. This takes place about 25 years in the future from now. I haven't fixed the date firmly because I haven't looked at my timeline. But it's at the end of a period of depressions and wars and political upheaval, so everyone's kind of walking around with PTSD of one sort or another. And so everybody is very, as you get when you live in a low, extremely low trust culture, you get very sort of suspicious and touch averse.
25?
Survival mechanism. So they're all, that's in the mix here too.
Yeah, that makes sense. Both, yeah. So, anyway, how about you, Dan? How did your writing day go today?
It didn't go as well as I hoped. I was needing to get 3K in to get back in the groove that I wanted to, but I was 3 hours getting my teeth into it. Once I got my teeth into it, it flowed, but I wound up with a total of 38,501, which gave me 1,953 for the day. But I think once we're done here, I'll be able to get a good start on tomorrow's words. I did have, however, an unexpected haunting.
Ooh, do tell.
One of the recently murdered people has just appeared to another member of the crew and told her that someone on the ship is not who they appear to be, and revealed to her things about the kleptomaniac that nobody else knew, and then disappeared just before someone else didn't, like, poof, vanish, but managed to get away out of sight. So just before someone else came into the room, and it is unclear to the haunted person whether it's a ghost or a demon or a dream. But whatever it is, it's telling her things she shouldn't be able to know otherwise.
Ooh.
I'm going for a slice of pepperoni pizza.
Yes. So that's going to be fun. It'll add a third twist to the two I was already planning. So the ending of this is just going to be twist, twist, twist. And it should go really, really nice.
That's exciting.
So, yeah.
So, questions tonight? Tori, did you remember any of yours?
Yeah, Tori, you said you had a question.
There was something. Okay. So in terms of hitting sort of a stalemate, I have tried to go to certain podcasts and things like that that elicit like an emotional sort of reaction from myself, and because sometimes I just look at it something and I just can't for some reason.
We need nouns.
I just can't quite figure out how to make this person speak to this person or make this fit. And maybe it's because I've switched to, like, from horror to, well, I'm in a horror to sci-fi fantasy, and it's kind of all over the place at this point. So how do you, and I'm happy with where I'm going, right? But I do want to make it continuous. I want to add to the continuity, but it's really hard when I'm where I am.
Okay, so that's pretty vague. Can you concretize the problem? Can you give us I'm having trouble getting this character to do that thing or something like that?
So there is a specific character who is the main character, and she's sort of working through why she has seen this other character before in photographs and other things and in documents that are not from her era. Mm-hmm. And I think I was starting to write the horror, and then I totally neglected the fact that I need to do more of a historical review. So I think this is just my insanity of being someone who has to be perfect. If it's not, this is my nonfiction coming in, because I can't not make it perfect, and I don't know how to counterbalance the two, or if there is, like, you can actually make it perfect, but
you can't make it perfect. Okay. And you especially can't make it perfect on the first pass.
Okay. It's really bugging me.
People who are able to release a first draft, and there are people out there, I can sometimes do it, not always, not even most of the time. Harlan Ellison used to write, like, at a typewriter in a bookstore in front of people and then release the story to the store's patrons on a Xerox machine at the end of it. There are people who can do that, but the way that they learn to do that is, A, they tend to write short. B, they have written millions and millions of words. So everything is internalized, and they have, you know, over decades learned to open those taps.
And I will add that as his publisher, the times that he does release a story that is more or less unedited except for typos, it's almost always a short story. In fact, I would say it's always a short story. Every long piece has required some continuity and development.
Yeah.
And most of the time he takes care of that by cycling.
Which is a technique I can tell you about. I've told the listeners about it a lot, so I'll tell you about it off air, but it's a way of doing multiple drafts at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But like Gail keeps quoting Merle Lafferty, you are allowed to suck. You actually do have to let it not be what you think it can be in order to get enough of it out to understand what you're dealing with. Stephen Cannell, who was the television writer and producer who did, like, The A-Team and Wise Guy and Rockford Files, he did, like, 35 television shows. He said that there are three stages of being a writer. The first stage, you have an idea, and you write it down, and it's just not as good as what you had in your head. Mm-hmm. And the second stage is you have an idea, and you write it down, and you read it, and you're like, wow, that's kind of what I was going for. And then the third stage comes years later, after you've been doing a lot of those two, when you have an idea and you write it down and you read it and you're like, how the hell did I do this? This is way better than what I had in mind.
I would be very happy.
Tori, can I ask, do you do any other kinds of, like, arts or crafts, like sewing, or do you cook or bake or anything like that?
I paint, actually.
Okay.
I used to, not now, but I used to paint quite a lot. And I would say... kind of okay at it.
Like watercolor or acrylics or what?
I would do acrylics, yeah.
All right, well, like, it's not dissimilar to the start of a painting, which is if you're laying in, and if you're doing oils, you're laying in, like, all the blues or the whites or whatever, and you're building your layers and stuff like that. You can't, you are at the beginning of the painting, and you can't expect it to look like the finished picture in your head, right? If you're just at the beginning, writing is exactly the same way. So, you know, you're just in one corner, or you've just put the wash down or whatever, you know, like if you're freaking outlining or whatever it is you're doing. So, like, it's like the expectations of yourself are what you have to just try to lower a little bit and just be like, no, like, and you're not going to invite anybody to see it at this juncture either. Right.
Right. Yeah, no. And it's helpful, really helpful listening to y'all talk about these things, because I absolutely have this problem in terms of, because I'm like, coming out of nonfiction and coming out of writing for people who are crushing you for your facts, right? So it's kind of, I know you know this, you're very well like versed in this. And for me, it's really tough to not be so hyper judgmental of myself and to just let it go. I teach my students every time I teach them. I'm like, oh, don't worry. Just like, it's fine. And then I come to myself and I can't live up to it.
Perfectionist tendencies are the hardest thing to
do. They really,
like,
are.
I mean,
yeah.
I'm a cook, so I think of it this way. And I like to do layered cooking, you know, mm-hmm. like Thai soups and stews and that sort of stuff. And like, you, the more you cook, the more you get accustomed to, like, tasting the broth at the very beginning and knowing where it can go, right?
Yep.
But you can't
mm-hmm.
judge the soup on that, right? If you're making a gumbo, you don't judge the gumbo on the roux. It's just the frickin' roux. You got to still throw everything else in there. But you can look at, like, after you've made gumbo 100 times, you can look at the roux and be like, that's the wrong chocolatey color, right? Like,
yep.
Yeah.
So, like, Dan and I are at the wrong chocolatey color, you know, but you guys are making gumbo for the first frickin' time, right? So, like, the fact that you made a roux is a big victory, and you haven't burned it. it, right? Like,
yeah,
so,
and
like,
you got to, yeah, you got to keep in mind that she and I both have in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 million words published.
No big deal.
That means of such a quality that they're publishable, and we each have about 1 million words before our first words were published. We've been doing this a long time. We've had a lot of practice.
One of the things I love about, I do one retreat. I mean, I do multiple retreats, but one retreat I do is a mixed bag of authors that include established authors and newer authors and stuff, which is, so it's a little bit like Nano. And one of the things we do is what I call accountability reading, which is basically at the end of the day, we read something out loud that we wrote that day. That's the requirement. And it's usually just about, you know, 500 words or something. You don't have to read very much. There's no critique involved at all. Although, you know, if you're me, you try to pick a funny scene so you can make people laugh. But one of the reasons I like that is A, I like accountability. Obviously, that's why I'm doing this. But B, I think it's really good for all of the newer authors to hear how bad all of the established authors are when all they're reading is their first draft, because it really sucks. Like, the first draft sucks for everybody, and we stumble over it, and we get mad at ourselves for a sentence that we've written. Like, I'll be reading something out loud, and I'll just be like, oh, that's not good. I'm going to fix that, you know? But I think it's really good for for authors to realize, like, the rough drafts are awful. They're just awful. And like, I know it's hard to turn off a perfectionist tendency. Like, I really, really do know that, but it doesn't help a writer. It really does.
One thing you may be able to side port from your academic career though, into this painting, sculpting, fiction, they're dialectic art forms.
Mm-hmm.
They take the shape in the making.
Mm-hmm.
When you're writing an academic paper, the dialectic happens in the classroom, on the archaeology site, while you're arguing with your co-authors. And the shape of the paper takes shape at that stage. And then as you're writing it, you're basically organizing the thoughts that you have already developed.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing art, the development is part of the finished product. It may not be visible to the audience, but it all happens in the medium.
Together.
It doesn't happen, you know, at the bull session.
Yeah, because I'm used to having different, like, okay, here's my research, here's what I've done
right.
in the field, here's what this person has told me about mm-hmm. this, and blah, blah, blah. So,
yeah. When you sit down to write a article for a scientific journal, you're sitting down at just the conclusion phase and putting it all together.
Hopefully.
But when you sit down to write fiction, you're sitting down much earlier at the working out the arguments phase and checking things for holes phase. But you're doing that all on paper instead of verbally or just in notes.
Yeah, that's a different part of the brain.
Ooh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the creative part of the brain.
Yeah.
The presentation part of the brain is not the creative part of the brain. It's a different part. And it does come into play at the tail end of the process when you're getting things, you know, gussied up for publication.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual artwork happens in the creative part of the brain, which in the sciences is an earlier part of the process than the paper.
It's like what's going on in your head is like the sort of fictional internalized version of a discussion group seminar.
Yes, it really is.
Like, no, arguments are just occurring between characters or between you and your creative muse, or
it's like you know me.
World building or whatever, and nothing's been really fermented. But the act of arguing with other people in your own head about what's going on will eventually yield up some sort of conclusion that you could maybe turn into a paper, right?
And if your characters are arguing with themselves in your head, all you have to do is write it down, and you've got a scene.
And I feel very badly about the people who live around me, because I tend to act them out in full voice.
Like a good idea.
Yeah, I just, if I'm writing dialogue, I'm not there yet. I can't write dialogue without narrating it.
And I still do that. I do it subvocally now, but you know, I will sit and I'll write a sentence and I'll be like, it says what I want it to say, but it doesn't sound right, and so I'll like very quietly to myself do the accent of the character.
Exactly.
And so that I can find where the rhythm of the speech is broken down. Yeah, so yeah, that's a great thing to do.
This is what I'm teaching. I'm like, this is why pronunciation, this is why like commas and semicolons and all of these things are so important, because they help us to realize where we need to place the emphasis.
Well, yeah, in fiction, punctuation is not just grammatical, it's also musical notation.
Mm. Oh,
it's
true.
It's like the rests and the dots in a musical score.
I'm learning that now, and it makes it easier when I speak it out loud, and I'm very sorry for every... They're not listening. They can't hear me.
No.
I'm very sorry for anybody, but I'm not, because you know what? It's an amazing story, and whatever.
So does that help?
Yes, it helps. Oh, thank you guys good. So much.
The other helpful thing, which I keep saying this in lockdown especially, is like you talk about being, for lack of a better way of thinking about it, gracious with your students, and learning to extend that grace to yourself will make you healthier as a writer.
Very true.
Yeah, it's just that thing about like why am I so kind to the people I love and I never extend that kindness to myself, like, and it's just you have that.
And in the arts that's particularly important, because an artist is professionally insane. And so
I'd never have guessed.
I'm in the right job. Yeah.
People keep saying that.
No, it's
but like I don't make my best art when I'm upset or crazy.
No, I didn't say upset. I said insane.
I'm gonna go look up the definition of sanity.
Art can express rational ideas, but it is not itself a rational process. It works when you lower barriers that we normally keep up for the sake of polite society. Sometimes those are barriers of ideas you shouldn't think, but sometimes it's just the barrier between what you know to be real and what you imagine might be real, and you let them mix. Art is the importation of the dream world into the waking world, and that is by definition an exercise of insanity. It's not a destructive one. But it's not a sane process, and so, you know...
It's so weird to think as of irrational and insane as the same thing.
Well, sanity is the... someone who is sane has cohesion in their sense-making. And when you're deliberately breaking the bounds of sense-making in order to make more sense of something or explore an idea or make something beautiful, you're deliberately dropping sanity for a while. In order to make that happen,
it's an interesting way of thinking about it. I'm always insane, so I don't know that it's more or less when I create a.
Well, so am I. But,
same.
Oh, well. Do we want to take a question from the forum, or no? We don't have time, do we? I don't know.
Well, yeah, we've been at this about 23 minutes. If everyone wants to stick around, we can do it now, or we can do it tomorrow. It's okay either way. It's a substantial episode already. I think I want to get back to my words, because I've just had someone get haunted, and now I have aftermath to deal with.
Fantastic. Well, you go deal with your aftermath. I'll have some dinner and talk to you all tomorrow.
Sounds excellent. See you all tomorrow, everybody.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.